This recording is produced from open reel tapes originally recorded for Vancouver Community College, Langara campus in 1973. This program forms part of the Langara College Real History Project, which restores and preserves British Columbia's oral history. This project is funded in part by the British Columbia 2000 Millennium Arts and Heritage Fund in partnership with Vancouver Public Library and Langara College. Copyright for this product is held by Langara College. It may not be reproduced in whole or in part in any form without permission from the copyright holder. The title of this recording is Winnipeg Strike 1919. The interviewer is Lawrence Fast. The interviewees are William A. Pritchard and Norman Penner. The audience consists of students and faculty of Vancouver Community College.
This interview is being filmed in the library of Vancouver City College, Langara campus. With me here are two men who have a strong interest in the events of the Winnipeg General Strike of 1919. This first gentleman and socialist here is Mr. William Pritchard, who was active as a leader in that strike. The other gentleman who is over here with me is Mr. Norman Penner, who has recently edited a book called Winnipeg 1919, which consists primarily of the story of the Winnipeg strike as told by the strikers. The book was published this year by James, Lewis, and Samuel in Toronto. I might add here that the events of the next few days with Mr. Pritchard and Mr. Penner were set in motion by the publication of the book and by a review of the book, which I wrote and which was published in the Vancouver Sun about 2 months ago. Most of the events of the next few days were arranged by Mrs. McLachlan of the Social Sciences Department of Vancouver City College. But we're here to talk about the book. Mr. Penner, would you tell us just how you came to write the book?
Well, I knew that there was in the historical treatment of the strike a blank space that there had been written a striker's account of the strike, and I felt that I had long felt that should be made available to the public. And I found it one night in the dusty shelves of the library of one of my friends, and with the help of York University and the Canada Council, we decided to publish it and make this available so that all sides of the story of the Winnipeg General Strike would become known to the public.
Just how long was this under publication? I think you had a few difficulties with publication.
Well, first of all, in deciding what of the material, which part of the material that was available should go into the book. There was some disagreement with the readers of the Canada Council as to whether we should print Pritchard's speech or Dixon's speech. We only had room for one. We decided on Pritchard's speech finally because we felt that his dealt with a wider perspective than the strike alone and put the strike trials in their proper perspective. Dixon was, of course, a participant in the Winnipeg General Strike. And as you know, Mr. Pritchard just wandered into Winnipeg to address a meeting and was arrested and became a figure of the strike without having anything to do with it.
Is that what happened, Mr. Pritchard?
That's right. I was 4 days, I think, there. And on the matter of the story of the strike as written by the Defense Committee, no one would claim that it is a literary gem, but it was created by working men. And as you noted, several hands were in this pie. It had to be done in a hurry, and the job was set out. I think I have some piece in there somewhere dealing with the publications that were banned under the censorship. Mm-hmm. That's about all the contribution I made to it. Mm-hmm. And I also noted my peculiar literary architecture. Mm-hmm. And that's, I can pick it out now.
You know, you say, Mr. Penner, that this was written by the strikers. Now, just who were these? Now, you mentioned the Defense Committee.
Well, they were members of the Trades and Labor Council. Mm-hmm. From different unions, They formed the Defense Committee to raise funds for defense, and this was one way of doing it and telling the story.
Right.
So it may appear disjointed, but it's factual. Mm-hmm. You can bank on that.
Just on that point, there's one reference in the Stryker's account which seems to have been written in the penitentiary. The writer refers to the view that he's getting from the penitentiary walls. Mm-hmm. And so it must have been some of the men that were incarcerated, because they were incarcerated without bail, don't you know, before the trial. And they had a lot of time to contemplate in there, and they spent their time contemplating and writing about it.
Mr. Bridges,
it was written in between the time of the preliminary hearing and the main trial. So I think the hand there is that of Ivan's.
Ivan's, it sounds like it.
And he had a tendency to romanticize, and so the jail would look like a penitentiary. And it's a good story.
How much of this did you write, Mr. Pritchard? How much of the Stryker's account? Did you write any of it?
Very little. I had very little time there to write. Maybe it's back in here.
Well, he wrote the speech.
The speech, I know, yes.
Oh, yes.
About the rest of it. How long were you in the prison, Mr. Pritchard?
Oh, I was in several. In Calgary, the city jail, and then the mounted police, so they could allow me to shave. Mm-hmm. And in the Calgary jail, they wouldn't even give you a knife to cut your meat with in whatever came as dinner. But in the mounted police, they took me out there so I'd get a good bath and a shave, and they let me in the bathroom mm-hmm. with a full razor. You know, and you couldn't cut your throat in the city jail, but you could do it in the other.
Maybe
also, the window was open, and you could jump out.
They trusted you.
Then they came and said, "Are you ready to go?" And I said, "I'm ready." Well, they weren't ready. They were playing cards. So I sat down and watched them
maybe
play cards.
Maybe they believed their own story about you and thought you were a very
stories.
Violent man.
I remember those boys. They said, "Well, how would you like a ride around the city?" So I had a ride around the city before it took my...
Well, this was great.
Let me see where I am.
The RCMP
now.
Grey Line Tour?
Mm-hmm. Eh?
Was this the RCMP Grey Line Tour?
And yes. In regard to your first point, Mr. Fast, who wrote it? There were also several excerpts from the Daily Strike Bulletin, which was printed. And those could have been members of the strike committee. They could have been contributed by what we would call worker correspondence.
Right.
But they do all reflect the whole spirit of the strike. Mm-hmm. That's what's so marvelous about the book, is the spirit rather than the writing itself. Yeah. The spirit of defiance, the spirit of conviction, the spirit of social history. I think probably this is more a book of social history than of anything else, mm-hmm. because it views Winnipeg from the viewpoint of the working people of that city.
I think you mentioned in your introduction something about this being a watershed of the social movement in Canada, and I think that's where its real importance lies right now. Mr. Pritchard?
Well, answering your question, Doctor, page 223 mm-hmm. of Mr. Penner's book, The Crown's Case, and right on through here, dealing with all the material that was banned, which included Gilbert and Sullivan's operas, and fragments of science by Tyndall.
That's certainly subversive.
Darwin's, this is what the blanket mm-hmm. did. That's censorship when it goes crazy. Well, right from there, then I recognize the, as I say,
your own verbal
architecture. The fine Italian hand that wrote these. Because I suppose then as now, I had the dubious reputation of spilling out long sentences and leaving everybody in suspense. When is the verb coming? You see, Mrs. Steve told me, Bill, she said, I just sat there shivering, but you came up. You had
You're
a predicate.
To an English professor now.
You never failed them. The verb always came.
I don't know. But that's there. That's it. And it's there.
Mr. Pritchard, would you say that this description of the strike is essentially correct?
As given by
the... Right, as given by the strike.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. The facts are there. It may be in skeleton form. The facts are there.
Mr. Penner, how do you feel?
Well, I feel that it certainly closes the gap in the published material on the strike. And I feel that it presents the striker's case in a way that has not been hitherto presented.
It is, after all, one side of the story, isn't it?
It's
which
one...
adds to the total picture.
Yes, yes.
Let me go on to a different topic. There was a lot of talk about a Red Scare about 1919. A Red Scare, a Bolshevist scare. Was there any justification for such a scare, Mr. Penner?
Well, perhaps Mr. Pritchard would...
Well, the war was over, and conditions were bad. And even the soldiers' wives were still getting the same allowance that was allowed them at the beginning. That's until we made a noise here in Vancouver through the Trades Council. And
To answer that question a little further, even the title Red Scare, which is what it was, would suggest an emotional, irrational reaction to what was then, of course, the impact of the Russian Revolution.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the powers that the establishment were thrown into hysteria by the Russian Revolution and by the impact that it had throughout the world. Just to show how irrational it was, when the as we report in the Striker's account and in my introduction, when Premier Borden was in Versailles at the peace conference, he received a hysterical telegram from the cabinet, which was left in charge of Sir Thomas White and Arthur Meehan, in which they said, Bolshevism is sweeping through Canada. Please get the British to station a warship off the coast of Vancouver, and this should have a settling effect on the thing.
They were thinking of Mr. Pritchard in Vancouver, I think.
They were thinking of Mr. Pritchard, and they were thinking... They equated every strike, every demonstration, as a communist plot, as a Bolshevik attempt. And also, this continued. This continued. You know, I have a document issued by the Department of Labor under nobody's signature, in which, written in August 1920, after the trials are already over, warning the people of Canada that the three most threatening Bolsheviks in Canada are, one, J.S. Woodsworth, two, William Ivins, and three, R.B. Russell. And this was expanded upon by a book that appeared by the ex-chairman of the Political Economy Department of the University of Toronto, a man named James Maber, who said the three most dangerous Bolshevik organizations in Canada are, one, the Methodist Church, in its entirety, two, the trade union movement in its entirety, and three, and this is an order of importance, one was the main one, was the Methodist Church, only three was the Communist Party of Canada, which was a very small fledgling organization that had just been founded. So I think that, like all scares, there was an element, a great element of hysteria and irrationality about it.
How long did this last? Until this whole scare died down. Still there?
Well, I just picked up a book that's just been issued, a new book out called The Dilemma of Canadian Socialism by Gerald Kaplan. And he reminds us that when the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation came into existence in 1932 and 33 under the leadership of Woodsworth, R.B. Bennett swore up and down that this was a communist organization and had to be dealt with as such. That was in 1933.
Let me go on to something else. In this little speech, Mr. Pritchard, on the state trials,
yes,
you mentioned that there is no record of the state trial in the archives, in the Manitoba archives. Does that mean there is no public record of this trial anywhere?
It's gone. That is the statement of Jack Walker, who is in McMurray's office, brought him, a young lawyer. He wasn't born at the time of the trials. He tried. Professor McCormick, who teaches Canadian history in Winnipeg University, he tried to get them, find them. And he said, you can get the transcript of any trial in the history of Manitoba except this one, which was the biggest. They had a bigger panel of jurors, of veneer men, for this trial than for the whole of the assizes. And this was for just one trial. And then they had the effrontery to make a motion in court that they be allowed to extend that panel indefinitely.
Mr.
That is when I made my famous little talk on what is called Pritchard's Cake and Eat It speech.
Mr. Penner, did you find a transcript of the trial anywhere? A complete transcript?
I found sections. I found the judge's charge.
Oh, they were published?
Yes.
The defense committee published that.
Yes. But you mean the
the transcript of the all of the trial itself.
Yes, I wouldn't...
His speech to the his talk to the jury was published.
Yes.
In the Russell case.
Yes, because that was taken to the Privy Council. The defense committee decided to appeal the Russell case to the Privy Council in the hope that would be a test case of the legality of the.
What do you think happened to the transcript? Was it deliberately destroyed somewhere, you think?
One can follow the lead of the Watergaters and surmise, you see. And at that point in time, whatever, somebody went down and took them out of there, like Great took the Gemco and he burned them.
It became inoperative.
Yes. Yeah. Constitution.
Just on that one reference, now that we're talking about Watergate, I think there is, without stretching the point too much, a similarity between the essential content of the Watergate and the essential content of what the government did in 1919. Because the government in 1919 bent the laws, ignored the laws, or made post facto laws to suit their purposes in order to convict the strikers. The strikers were sentenced under an amendment to the criminal code which was not in existence when they were arrested. J.S. Woodsworth also mentions in a speech that he made when he first took his seat in Parliament that the Citizens Committee of 1000 hired a private detective agency to spy on the workers to supplement the already espionage activity of the RCMP, and that although these were hired by the Citizens Committee, the bill for them was secretly paid by the federal government.
So it was a case of inventing a law to suit the crime.
That's right.
In that connection, and I have friends in Vancouver, you know, still, and they want me to tell them about the iniquity in the other fellow's backyard. I said, just a minute, as young people, don't worry about Watergate. That's Uncle Sam's business. It's amusing, but remember this. Canada had its Watergate half a century ago. The same spy system, the same arrests before laws were passed legalizing. They took all those fellows to Stony Mountain, you know.
Yeah.
Sharitonoff and all those boys from the north. I met those in the penitentiary. They were arrested, then the law was passed afterwards. The correspondence is there. And this fellow, Andrews, he made a little fortune out of being deputy Minister of Justice, and then leading counsel for the Crown.
Right? Yes, he was actually the chairman of the Citizens Committee.
And they
was supposed to be a private committee.
Right.
He was acting Deputy Minister of Justice, and then he turns up as Chief Crown Prosecutor in the trials, and his bill for the latter services were $32,000.
Paid by the Citizens Committee?
No, paid by the federal government.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
And he had a hard time, of course, deciding on which day he was Deputy Minister of Justice and which day he was Chairman of the Citizens Committee. For instance, after the Bloody Saturday when the riot took place, when one person was killed and 30 wounded, Andrews arrives at the office of the print shop, which was printing the strikers' paper, and said, "You must forthwith cease and desist printing this paper." Signed A.J. Andrews. And then he hurried to put on Deputy Minister of Justice.
He was a quick change artist.
This was foreshadowing Hitler, that horrible man. We had him here. Well, 10 o'clock in the morning until 10 at night for a trial. You know, they usually go home for supper at 5. And I was doing my best to keep my end alive, and I referred to my distinguished and learned friend, who evidently was getting a good fee for daytime and time and a half for overtime, and I wanted to be treated the same, and I was getting nothing. And that's what I've got now at the end of it.
But didn't you also...
But a lot of fun.
Didn't you also characterize your legal friends on the other side as embodiments of learned ignorance?
yeah,
that's your phrase.
Indoor minds, that was the first I used on the lawyers. Our lawyers as well as the other fellows. They were all the same. They're outside the realm of life. Dry, law.
Mr. Penner, would you say there's a new interest in the events of the strike?
Yes,
year or two?
Yes, definitely. And I think it goes hand in hand with a general re-looking that's taking place at the history of Canada. Professor Stuart Jameson at the University of British Columbia published a book a few years ago called Labor Unrest in Canada, and he makes the point in general that every generation must look at history anew, fresh. And I think this is happening. And one of the greatest sources of interest to the student youth particularly is the history of the labor movement, which they're beginning to see in a new light, and which is essential to get a proper understanding of the forces that are at work, because this country was not made by the prime ministers, was not made by the generals, was made by the people. And a very important element in making that history has been the history of the labor movement, of which this was probably the climactic point.
Isn't that the history of any society?
Yes.
Not names and dates and kings and queens and their mistresses and paramours, but the activity of those who produce wealth.
Right.
That's what keeps society going.
Right.
If that stops, we die. Of course. That's the basis.
And I must say, just as a personal note, that in studying the history of Winnipeg 1919, it's a great thrill to me to meet one of the central figures.
Right.
So we're not that far away from the history that we're talking about.
Oh, we have a living link right here.
A living link.
Yes.
And all of the reviews, without exception, have congratulated us on putting out this book, on making this document available, and in making Mr. Pritchard's speech available, and in reprinting the disclosures that were made in 1926 in the House of Commons by Peter Heenan.
Yeah.
About what actually went on behind the doors.
And that was read into hand.
That was read into
hand.
That's right.
In the short account in the strike bulletin that was edited by Ivans, they referred to my first speech when I went into Winnipeg in Victoria Park. And it's a short account, as any account must be, but the speech was long. But they get this in, and probably the reader wouldn't know what I was talking about. An appeal from Gideon drunk to Gideon sober. And the point was that the 12 months before this, the same man, Gideon Robertson, came into this town and ratified a collective bargaining undertaking by the Metal Trades Council of this city. And 12 months later refused to take the same position in Winnipeg. That was the drunk and the sober. I can tell you more about this fellow, because he came down to Victoria when I was Reeve, and his finger was to stop the relief work in Burnaby. He was after my hide. And I brushed it all aside, and I appealed to Premier Tommy, and I said, I know what this man is talking about and what is worrying him. And if so, I'll pack my bags at any time and go any place, and we'll have it out before the public. And I told them what's the matter.
On that point, Mr. Pritchard.
Just a minute.
Yeah, go ahead.
We were paying the people who worked down the ditch, down below, 25 cents a day more than the $4 that were paid to other workers. And this was 25 cents more than the relief was set by the government. But this was work undertaken under bond issue and was our contribution to the relief work. It was also a contract between the municipality and employees. And this man wanted us to break a contract between employer and employees. And this is the thing, they were going to stop that. And I came from Victoria one day back to Burnaby, and the order had come from Ottawa to close down all the relief work. I called a public meeting in North Burnaby and told the world at large, the relief work goes on tomorrow, be on the job. And that's what happened, you see. Then later, when we didn't get the money for the work we get done for the government, together with the overhead, five projects almost completed before we got a penny on the first one. The men that were digging ditches in the lanes and clearing parks and were in a worse position than the municipal employers on water, roads and sewers, there was no money for them. The money was there. It was in the sinking funds. And I was guilty of dipping into the sinking funds to pay these men. And the judge said, what could you do? I pleaded guilty. But he would suspend it. And he said, this man probably saved the municipality from revolution. And he sent word to Victoria that the acts of the chairman of finance and the treasurer and Reef Richard be legalized. That was his request. It hasn't been done yet.
Still waiting.
Huh?
Still waiting.
You know?
Mr. Penner?
Yes. Yeah. This the point that Mr. Pritchard makes about the inconsistency of Gideon Robertson ratifying a collective bargaining agreement in Vancouver, which he refused to ratify in Winnipeg the next year, is due, in my opinion, to at least two circumstances, which I suggest in my introduction. One is that the Manitoba establishment, the business establishment, of which Meehan was the representative on the cabinet, had a long history of very primitive labor relations. The fact the metal fabricating shops that triggered off the strike, the unions in those shops had been trying since 1906 to get an agreement. And the owners of those plants, with the full backing of Meehan, who was their man in the cabinet, refused point blank to agree to that. That was the first reason. The second reason is that Mr. Gideon Robertson, Senator Gideon Robertson, was a paid official of the American Federation of Labor, which saw in the one big union which was emerging out of the strike a real threat to the international union, so-called, the American-dominated Canadian union system. And they felt that any concession to the strikers in Winnipeg would in fact be a concession to the OBU, and under all circumstances it must not be allowed.
And had that one big union succeeded, it would have solved many of the breakaway problems we have right now.
That's right.
Canadian unions.
That's right. It was a genuine attempt of the Canadian working class to establish its own union and on an industrial basis.
Right. I have two more questions before we break off this section. First of all, I've heard that today students are turning away from violence and demonstrations and turning to the Communist Party in greater numbers. Have you noticed anything?
I don't know.
I would say from my viewpoint, I don't think it is that they are turning to the Communist Party. In fact, my understanding of it is that the Communist Party is the least of the Marxist socialist groups that is getting the benefit of a great resurgence in interest in Karl Marx.
Mm-hmm.
There are dozens and dozens of circles and associations and groups across this country, mainly in the universities, of young people who have taken to the study of Marxism. But I don't think it would be correct to say that the Communist Party is the beneficiary of that. I think it's most of the Marxist groups.
I hope it's true that they're turning away from noisy demonstrations and chanting of silly slogans. And in an essay we wrote some time ago, an appeal to the young, we asked that they stop shouting long enough to do some little thinking. That's the pace off. And
One short question. When will the NDP in Canada win the federal election?
That's his business. You can't ask a foreigner to answer that question.
Mr. Penner?
Well, I would give you an answer that is really no answer. When the working class has understood that it must break from the capitalist